Tracy's on. Turn up the microphone. She's talking sports, so you're about to learn a ton. At 8:33, she hangs out with Mike and me. And you know from the song that now's the time with Tracy's on.
Welcome back to Cairo Nights.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Another slow news day. We've had nothing but slow news days here on Seattle Sports at Night. But
very low key.
But before we get into that, so have you ever heard of Leonard Bernstein?
No.
Leonard Bernstein is, I think he might be dead at this point. I'm pretty sure he is. He was a very famous conductor, 60s, 70s, probably into the 80s for New York Philharmonic, considered one of the great American genius symphony conductors. And so Leonard Bernstein, he traveled the world conducting various orchestras, but every now and then, this is my understanding, this story, I may not have this entirely right, but I think I'm pretty close. So he is, was widely considered, when he would travel out to the West Coast, one of the West's best conductors.
Oh, and there we go. There it is.
And
I knew it. I was like,
if
where is it going?
Leonard Bernstein were out here and wanting to conduct.
Yeah.
And he needed, like, I wanted to conduct today. I'm going to have to find an orchestra, a Philharmonic orchestra to rent. Where do I go? Where would he go?
You know, I know why you would be asking me this.
Right.
Why? Because you and I, as everyone knows, and everyone should be also, are huge fans of Start Rentals,
right,
which brings you Seattle Sports at Night.
Mm-hmm.
And they are the preferred supplier to the West Best contractors, but you know what? I wouldn't rule out that they're also the preferred supplier to the West Best conductors.
You think so?
I think that there's probably similar interest levels there. The little Venn diagram of what contractors want and what conductors want. I
kind
think there's
the
a
same.
Lot of overlap.
They both are,
it's a complete circle.
Trying to get a large group
circle.
Of people to do one thing in unison. Well,
exactly.
Right. So it would make sense that he might call Star and see.
He'd call Star Rentals.
Because as you said, have said avocados. I think you said they can rent an octopus.
So here's
there's
what
no
Star
reason
Rentals...
they can't rent to a conductor, one of the West's best conductors. They couldn't rent an orchestra. All right. So the today's slow news day began early in the morning for me when I'm not. I woke up, I don't know, a little unusually early, and I'm checking for, because as on radio shows, you kind of start the day desperate for what am I going to talk about today? And sure enough, it popped up almost immediately. A blockbuster story in The Athletic. Stacey, can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so The Athletic, just so you guys can find it, I'll tell you what it is. It's called What is Driving the Rift Between Russell Wilson and the Seahawks? Power and Control. It is an article written by a trio of Athletic reporters, Michael Sean Dugar, Mike Sando, and Jason Jenks, all of whom are wonderful reporters and writers. They've compiled, collectively, the three of them, this story, or this article in The Athletic, that tells the story of this power fight, tug of war between, essentially, at its core, Pete Carroll and Russell Wilson, though there's a third party there, John Schneider, that it's kind of hard to tell like where he stands with everything. But the focus of the article is obviously on head coach and quarterback. Now, it is not weird to have two powerful parties within a team fighting, right?
Going especially back, if you're like the Green Bay Packers, for example.
Exactly.
Aaron Rodgers has famously warred with his coaches.
You've had Terry Bradshaw and Chuck Noll. I mean, back through
Tom
the years.
Tom Brady and
Bill Belichick.
Right.
Back through the years, the NFL is no stranger to drama and dramatic stories. And so many of those have been when stars kind of go head-to-head with the head coach. And most especially when it's a quarterback. Because it's one thing to be a star tight end or whatever. A quarterback, his career might outlast yours as a head coach. It is a little bit different. And so that is quarterback is more like this middle management kind of player. Not
by definition, because the most important player
is the quarterback.
Maybe in professional sports is a professional football quarterback.
Right.
I mean, if they're good, they are fundamentally important to your whole overall success.
Right. So the reason that this article is, you know, being very widespread this morning isn't just because it's an inside look into this really fascinating relationship between Pete Carroll and Russell Wilson and how that has changed over 10 years in Seattle, but also because as part of the story, they say Russell Wilson and his camp are interested if the Seahawks should choose to part ways with him in in being traded to the following teams, and he includes some teams. And that's since been backed up by Russell Wilson's agent, who reached out to an ESPN reporter, Adam Schefter, and said, hey, Russell Wilson wants to be in Seattle, but if the Seahawks trade him, here are the four teams he'd be interested in going to, and then list the four teams.
And he actually can list this because he has a no-trade clause that he had been wanting in his contract and got it in his last contract.
Very important to know. So the no-trade clause is where it doesn't mean he can't be traded. It means that the player has to approve the trade. So if the team says, without a no-trade clause, the Seahawks could send Russell Wilson to Houston and be like, sorry, have fun there.
Right.
We wanted their early round picks. With the no trade clause, Russell Wilson can say, yeah, I'm not going to Houston. I'm not going to approve that trade. So the article looks at, speaking of the no trade clause, how the relationship between the two parties has, I want to say evolved, but maybe a better word is devolved. Personally, as a reporter who's covered this team, I feel that both Russell Wilson and Pete Carroll share so many traits in common.
Right.
It's wild that this relationship, as it's portrayed in the Athletic's article, is so strained. But I also understand why. So I'll explain. Both men are incredibly competitive. Both men obsessed with the legacies they're going to leave behind. And both men probably live and breathe football. Right.
Right.
When Russell Wilson was brought into Seattle, it was as this young, exciting quarterback who, first of all, was being paid practically nothing because he was a third round pick. So he took up like 1% of the salary cap. He was a mobile quarterback who was really exciting, but really this team's bread and butter, in addition to having an incredibly talented young quarterback, its bread and butter was its defense, full of, you know, Pro Bowlers, all pros and future Hall of Famers. And it's run game with Marshawn Lynch. So when Russell Wilson, when it came time to pay him, Seattle kind of had to make a shift. It parted ways with some of its aging players on defense. It obviously parted ways with Marshawn Lynch, and that would have happened anyways. These players are getting older.
Right.
But the strength of the team started shifting, or the money spent started shifting to offense, namely to Russell Wilson, who is now taking up a lot closer to 20% of the cap. So as a result of that, according to this article, and honestly, you don't have to say according to the article because it's just basic.
True.
It's not like they're spreading lies like this.
Right.
That means that you had less money and draft capital to spend on an offensive line. So this is an issue that is compounded by the fact that when Seattle has made draft picks and has signed free agents for the offensive line, they haven't worked out. So what I found so fascinating about this story, Mike, and I know you and I were talking about this,
mm-hmm.
is that there is no hero in this story. There is no necessarily villain in this story.
It's one of the things that I inherently trust in a good news story, and that's something I am familiar with. Is when it's nuanced,
mm-hmm.
you know, and this one decidedly is. This is not, you know, one of those quick hit, you know, Russell's unhappy or Pete's unhappy and just clashing the two. This mm-hmm. actually goes through and sort of breaks down, you know, the way it is. Like it's sort of like when you listen to one of those really great podcasts and you dislike somebody, but then you learn more about them. And then suddenly you kind of like them. Like when you look at S-Town or one of those, mm-hmm. It had actual character.
So good.
Development, right? Yeah. I mean, in this story, now that's front-loading the story with a lot of pressure, but nonetheless, they kind of got there. They actually really, I thought it was the best dissertation on their relationship that I have read, period, since I've been in Seattle. At least, well, the 10 years that I've been here, I've not read something better.
No, and there's so much volleying that it naturally does that you find yourself doing in conversations and you think, yes, this is what a nuanced article does. It looks at what's become a huge thing, a relationship between two powerful men in a powerful multi-billion dollar industry, and looks at how difficult it is to find where blame lies and find a solution. And I think Seahawks fans everywhere are hoping that there's a solution, because another thing the article does is point out how talented Russell Wilson is and just how hard it is to find that all-valuable franchise quarterback. The article also points to the idea that, well, I mean, there's some stuff Russell Wilson has done, too, to kind of make this hard on himself. And it's this back and forth with, you know, well, the Seahawks have struck out in free agency and have messed up these picks. Well, Russell Wilson stumbled and had turnovers in the second half of the season. Well, the offensive line fell apart. Well, if Russell Wilson wasn't taking up so much cap, it really lays out almost like an internal monologue of what you would be going through when you were trying to figure out the steps of the ingredients that got you to a problem. And I think, too, first of all, there are a lot of details in here I haven't even started to go over. I can't believe I forgot them, but I'm sure you saw them too. The moment where Russell Wilson is at one point in a meeting with Seahawks brass and his ideas are presumably rejected or not embraced and he storms out,
right?
There's a lot of different points there. One where Russell Wilson's camp finds out that John Schneider is going to be at Josh Allen's pro day and that the team was very interested at one point in drafting Patrick Mahomes. Would he have fallen to them? And those led respectively to Wilson pushing for a no trade clause in his deal. So that this relationship has taken some hits over the course of years.
Yeah. And that's the thing, because whenever we were talking about when this thing first surfaced, this sort of dispute, when Russell Wilson actually brought up the I'm getting hit too much, it made, and we remember we had this conversation about it's unusual for him to go out publicly with it. It's unusual for him to have this. Normally he is the, you know, the team's working together and gives you nothing but beige quotes perpetually. But then you read this story and you realize, like, because what we were misinterpreting, I think, or at least what I was misinterpreting at that point, was that it seemed like a switch had flipped in Russell.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that switch has been moving for a while now. And that's what this article really puts into context. Like, this isn't Russell being angry this year about an early exit from the Rams. This is Russell being angry for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly he got to that point where, all right, this is our, you know, one of the other arrows we have in the quiver is the public one. And that's what sort of kicked all of this thing in motion. And my guess is that while the reporters at The Athletic probably knew some of these details, when they heard that, they knew someone's frustration was very high and they knew the team's frustration was very high. And I gotta say, as a reporter, when you know frustration is high, that's when you can get people to talk to you. And this is, I think that this, him going public, led to this story.
Yes.
Speculation on my part.
I think that you're 1,000% correct. And I also think that him going public created this next chapter to the story, which the story obviously doesn't solve because it remains this incredibly difficult and yet unsolved thing, which is how do you move forward? One of the things the story points out is the two men, Russell Wilson, Pete Carroll, philosophically believe in different ways to win. Both value winning more than anything in the world. Russell Wilson named his son Win, is obsessed with winning. Pete Carroll has a book called Win Forever. I mean, these two men are obsessed with winning.
Right.
At their heart, they are competitors. They have very different ideas on how to do it. And both have merit and both are flawed.
Right.
And there is no one right answer. And what's really disheartening is the truth is probably somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, because in Russell Wilson's and Pete Carroll's defense, let's just say, apparently he did. And he said this afterwards. They hired the offensive coordinator he wanted, apparently.
Yeah.
So his frustration with that, it seems like that wasn't enough because they clearly recognized it, got him his own offensive coordinator, the one of his choosing. But he said all of this after that. So clearly there was a lot more there, and maybe he just got some impression that this is not a team that's going to do the things that he wants, even with an offensive coordinator. An offensive coordinator, believe it or not, is not out there blocking for you. And that doesn't really change a whole lot, especially if you have an offensive line like that. One of the things that gives an offensive line advantage is if they're not a great offensive line is subterfuge. If they don't know whether you're going to run or pass, that gives them time.
Yep.
That gives them time to adjust. The defense has to react.
Or misdirection.
Totally. Somehow. All that kind of stuff. Yep. And it could be that he felt like, oh, wait, they're giving me a new offensive coordinator, but all they're really going to do is like scheme with these same guys, with the exception of Dwayne Brown, right? I mean, who is exceptionally good.
Yes.
And that's not enough for me. But I got to say, sometimes when I look at athletes, I mean, I've seen baseball players as much complain about this. When you decide to, and justifiably. I don't mind you getting all the money you can, but when you decide to take up that much of the available money,
right,
there is going to be a cost to that, at least if not immediately, certainly down the road.
Exactly. And that's where this also becomes such a fascinating conversation, because if Russell Wilson, you should never, I really, really try to stay away from, like you just said, telling an athlete, this is when you earn all of your wealth, essentially.
Right.
I mean, I shouldn't say that. There are athletes that go on to lead incredibly successful careers post-playing career, whether
right.
it's in broadcasting, whether it's in whatever else they want, right? Politics, business, whatever. For a lot of NFL athletes, your prime earning potential, when you can get millions per year, which is rare, is now.
Right.
And people will complain about it, but it's because they're exceptionally talented at something that is in demand in a multi-billion dollar industry.
And there's not a lot of people doing it.
I don't know how to tell you that,
right.
like, if you could jump 6 feet in the air, maybe you should, you know, go be an athlete.
Well, but it also could be. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no. I was just going to say, this is a separate, even separate from Russell Wilson, his issue in Seattle. This is something that had been bubbling under the surface in the NFL in general, is people saying, you know what, these quarterback salaries are growing at such a rate. Are we going to see teams that truly can't win when their quarterback is taking up 20%+ of the salary cap? Because if that happens, you need to hit on every other thing you do. It's not impossible, but you can't have draft misses. You can't have free agent misses.
Right.
Teams are also going to have those.
So I read something interesting a few years ago that I kind of liked about how they create all these rules to protect quarterbacks because they know how valuable they are, right? I mean, in other words, like, you know, in the grasp, all these things to prevent a quarterback from getting hit or getting injured or something along those lines. And they overreact when it's a hit on a quarterback. But someone suggested, well, why don't they do that with salary as well? Why don't they give a separate quarterback cap that allows teams to devote more money to the quarterback? But then somebody really smart football observer, I can't remember who it was on the radio or maybe something I was reading, said the NFL wants quarterbacks to move around. They know that at any given time, mm-hmm. there's about eight great ones that are really sort of top notch. And then a bunch of other people who may luck into a Super Bowl if they have the right other fixes. But they don't mind the fact. They love the storyline when Tom Brady goes to Tampa. That is not necessarily bad for the NFL. If Russell Wilson goes somewhere else, I don't think there's anyone in NFL offices who are going to be unhappy. They're all going to, and so that's why they keep the salary cap as tight as they do and force people to make this decision or ship that expensive player somewhere else. And then they get a whole new bunch of people paying. I mean, essentially, it's like a giant shared quarterback system.
Well, and the league becomes, the NFL has, there are many reasons it's become the most popular sport in specifically the U.S., but one of the reasons is its parity. You look at baseball, which
exactly.
is incredibly regional in its fandom. With the Super Bowl, it'll be the most watched thing on TV every single year, and every year regular season games will be among the most watched events because it can always be your year.
Yeah. I mean, don't misunderstand this, and we got to wrap up pretty quick here, but when you see the Super Bowl ratings are down, the Super Bowl ratings going down, it's still the most watched.
Yeah, it's still millions and millions and millions.
It's not even close.
No.
You know, that is, and you're absolutely right. I mean, all of this kind of stuff, I don't know, it makes, now I'm interested. This is the stuff I dig. And
there
I know
Seahawks
that it's
fans that are like, Mike, stop, I'm so
stressed. I know, and I'm sorry. I apologize to you all personally in this manner. But, I don't know. This is going to be fun to see how it plays out. And I got to be, as a guy who grew up a Raiders fan, why did he say the Raiders? I love the Raiders,
sure.
but I understand why people don't. And it just seems like maybe he feels like John Gruden, and maybe he's had that quiet conversation with John Gruden, and he feels like this guy gets it because he did run Rich Gannon, who was an MVP of the league when Gruden was coaching, and he ran Rich Gannon in a manner that I think Russell Wilson greatly would appreciate.
I will say the four teams that he listed, the common similarity is offensive-minded head coaches.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, that's a very good point.
Yeah.
All right, Stacey, my guess is we'll have a little bit more on this tomorrow because I think it's not going away anytime soon.
I don't think so
either. All right, see you then. Rachel Bell coming up right after the break. Stay tuned.
We don't believe you. Cause we
can ring my bell, Rachel Bell. You can ring my bell, Rachel Bell.
Welcome back to Cairo Nights. Kind of an auspicious day today for Rachel Bell. She is celebrating the 100th episode of her podcast, Your Last Meal.
Yes. And so usually on Your Last Meal, I interview celebrities. But this time, in honor of the 100th, I thought it would be fun to interview 100-year-old people. And by people, I mean women, because the women always outlast the men. So I interviewed three 100-year-old women who live in the Seattle region. And I'm just going to focus on one for this story here. But you can tune into the podcast to hear all of the stories. But I'm going to introduce you to a woman named Eleanor Owen. At 100 years old, Seattle's Eleanor Owen lives on her own in her big old house. She drives, she's not on a single medication, and she's sharp with an enviable memory. Her 100th birthday was in January.
I have 300 birthday cards, if not more, that I haven't opened yet. They sent me 100 roses from which my son and I are now making wine.
Wait. You can make wine out of roses?
Yes. My son and my husband had done it when he was a kid. And so now, if you were here, you would find an aroma in the house of something fermenting.
The rose wine will ferment all year. And Eleanor hopes to have a lot of guests over to drink it when she turns 101.
I suffer from an addiction called TSA, thrift store addiction.
Oh.
I have 312 wine glasses. Nice people would say that I collect.
Eleanor has one of the most varied and fascinating careers of anyone I've ever encountered. And she has the Wikipedia page to prove it. She grew up the daughter of Italian immigrants in New York's Hudson Valley. Eleanor was extremely bright and graduated 2 years early.
My first paying job was as a cover porter on the Newburgh Daily News for $17 a week. And I saved every penny and actually went to New York City and enrolled at Trapagan School of Design. I actually was fairly successful as a designer and costumer for modern dancers, primarily Merce Cunningham. I did all of his shows.
Eleanor was also an actor, and she was cast in 2 Broadway productions, a few off-Broadway shows, and she directed children's theater in New York. When her husband took a job that moved them to rural Washington and then to Seattle, she continued to teach drama. Eleanor and her husband had 2 children, and when he was a teenager, their son Jody started showing severe symptoms of schizophrenia. After she found a noose he had hung in the basement, she tried desperately to get him help. But he wouldn't take medication, and she could not get him hospitalized.
And a terrible tragedy took place. He took one of my husband's guns, went to a tavern, shot up in the ceiling of the tavern. Men jumped on him, but the gun went off and killed somebody. A tragedy that can't be undone. And my son was declared innocent by reason of insanity. My first visit to Western State Hospital, he just wasn't there. He could not return to reality.
Her son remained in the psychiatric hospital for many years, and Eleanor could not concentrate on anything else. So she quit her job as a professor at the University of Washington. She connected with other parents who were also unable to help their mentally ill children. And she started going to Olympia and meeting with legislators.
And my definition of grave disability was turned into law. Now, I did not know at the time that this was a difficult thing to introduce, get passed in both houses, and signed by the governor in 1 year.
The same year, 1979, Eleanor and those other parents formed the Washington Advocates of the Mentally Ill, which soon became NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, which is still the nation's largest grassroots mental health organization, providing support, education, and advocacy in 1,200 U.S. locations. Eleanor went from Broadway to mental health advocacy, and she continued to fight in Olympia, where she became known as the Barracuda. Eleanor's son, Jody, is now in his early 60s and doing very well. He lives on his own. He works. His medication is under control. He's thriving thanks to Eleanor's dedication. You can hear a whole lot more from Eleanor, including her last meal, by tuning in to the 100th episode of Your Last Meal. But here is her parting thought on how to age gracefully.
Oh, you have to keep your teeth. If you don't have good teeth, you're not going to be able to stay well.
So that's just a portion of my Eleanor interview. If you want to hear more with her, because she is, as you could hear, very fascinating, and you want to hear about her last meal, there are also two other women that I interviewed, and, you know, a 1-year anniversary, you're supposed to give the gift of paper, and a 50th anniversary, you're supposed to give the gift of gold. But little known fact, for your 100th, you're supposed to give meatballs. Not many people know that. So I interviewed the head of culinary at IKEA America to ask her, why did a furniture store full of umlauts become synonymous with Swedish meatballs? So that's on there as well. And also, a lot of people are eating alone during the pandemic. You know, if you're single and you live alone, chances are you've been eating alone a lot. So I had the host of a podcast called Dinner for One. It's this really great woman. She is an American expat who's living in France and Paris. And her podcast is about post-divorce, how she taught herself to cook and to enjoy eating by herself post-divorce, to kind of find herself again.
Wow. Yeah, this is a dynamite podcast. Thank you a bunch. I actually have a question sort of broadly about, does it feel like 100 podcasts? I mean, that's an extraordinary number to get to, given everyone, you know, is starting a podcast, but rarely do people actually make such a good one. And rarer still, does it last 100 episodes?
Thanks. Yeah, it does feel like 100 episodes because it's been 4.5 years.
Yeah.
A lot of people do, you know, a weekly podcast. So this one has been mostly bi-weekly. Sometimes we take 3 weeks to make it. So I feel like, you know, a lot of people have pumped out more than 100 by now. But when I think about it as 100 different celebrities that I've spoken to or met, then it kind of sounds like a lot to me. But yeah, I'm really, really proud of it. I am. This is my baby. Unlike a lot of podcasts where it's just discussion, there's a lot of production that goes into it. So we work hard. That's kind of the back stuff. And if you want to listen to this episode, you can text 100, just the numbers, 100 to 98973, and we'll text it to you. It's on all the podcast platforms. You could listen at yourlastmealpodcast.com. And that's where you can find all of the episodes. But yeah, like I said, this one is featuring 3 100-year-old women, which was a good lesson for me, because if you've been listening to me for a while, you can hear I speak quickly. And if you've been in a room with me, you know, I walk very fast and
right.
I think really fast, and I'm just a fast person. And when you're hanging out with 100-year-old people, they are not. And so I had to have a lot of patience to let them talk and kind of think in the middle of a sentence instead of interrupting them and trying to push, you know, to the next subject. So that was a good lesson for me.
All right, Rachel. Well, folks, make sure you download that one. It's dynamite. And Rachel, thanks. We will talk to you on, you're off Friday. We'll talk to you on Monday.
See you on Monday.
Coming up on Cairo Nights, our final thoughts for the evening right after the break. Please stay tuned. Folks, end of the show, done for the day, one more day of the week, and so we usually pick up a little speed on Thursday night for our final thoughts, our second to final thoughts for the week. Frank?
You know, I'm going to give our beloved listeners a little peek behind the curtain. We just installed today a new operating system that allows the radio station that we use to run the commercials and all the different shows. You know, it is called Zeta. Tonight, in fact, here in like 15 minutes, we're going to throw it into Zeta, and it's going to run the radio station starting, you know, later. And I just have to say, I have a little anxiety about this. Not because I don't trust the program. I do. Not because I don't trust the engineers. I trust them. I love the engineers. They're my favorite people, among my favorite people in the building. It's just, it's new. It's a car. I haven't had to drive before, and I'm just a little bit ill at ease about, you know, it being here and running tonight. It's going to be fine. It's a great, great program, but that's uppermost of my mind right now.
What Frank is also not telling you is that we've all been replaced by this program. So so none of us are actually going to be in anymore. You're
I'll
going to get
here.
A full computer likeness of all of us talking and laughing. Sorry, folks, that they're replacing us with a computer system, but we felt it best to tell you. Of course, this could also be a computer talking to you right now. Shane?
Who's to say? Who's to say? Yeah, I've got the same thing on my mind as Frank. I showed up. Beginning of this week, Monday, everything was totally normal, and I kept checking in every single day. Have they put the new software in? Have they put it in yet? And the day has finally come. And let me tell you, I'm excited and ready to go home and go to sleep.
Yeah.
I am not looking forward to learning, but I am looking forward to just getting better at it because, you know, you got to learn up and pick up the pieces and learn your tools of the trade. So it is what it is, but I think I'll enjoy it at some point.
Yep. Mike, how about you?
You know, I actually, since I my interface with the system is more narrow than either of yours. I have to learn NewsBoss, which is how we create stories and some of the audio recording software, but I don't have to deal with it to the same degree you folks do. I looked at the screens and they look more complicated than the old screens. And so, that's perplexing. Yeah. And then I just run. That's what I do immediately when I see that stuff. But I actually do feel your pain because I've been through in a variety of newsrooms, the upheaval that happens. And the problem for us, I think that's a problem in a lot of places, but I can only speak to newsrooms, is that so much is happening immediately. Like when you right. don't have the muscle memory to get something on air very quickly or online very quickly, it really is a stress point. So I guess what's on my mind is, you know, I hope that everyone survives this thing okay and doesn't end up, you know, punching out a screen somewhere because they're pretty unhappy with it. I was telling a story the other day on Twitter about our old laptops, the original TRS-80s laptops. If you've ever used one, you probably regret them as much as I do. And I literally chucked one off a balcony once that had eaten a story, and it was the last time it was going to eat anything. And
wow.
And so I get it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm generally pretty patient with technology, but big system overhauls are painful for everyone. Hey, just ask the people at Employment Security. So, folks, thanks for joining us once again. And we will be back with you tomorrow night before we get our weekend break. So we'll see you then.